This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Occasionally on Morning Edition, David Sedaris confides in us, and when he does, it's time to drop what you're doing. Since last Christmas, he's read a series of excerpts from his journals. He told us about his day job as an elf in Macy's Santaland. He told off people who tried to get him to quit smoking. And he explained how he nearly wrote for a magazine geared to men with a fetish for giant-sized women. His writing and delivery are so exceptional, his readings have prompted calls from the supervising producer of Seinfeld, the producers of a couple of soap operas, and a movie company. But how does Sedaris make a living? He cleans houses in Manhattan. He's been writing nights while holding day jobs for years. He was brought to NPR by producer Ira Glass, who saw Sedaris read from his diary in a variety show in Chicago. Before we meet Sedaris, let's hear an excerpt of his Santaland diaries about his job as an elf named Crumpet.
I wear green velvet knickers, a forest green velvet smock, and a perky little hat decorated with spangles. This is my work uniform. I have spent the last several days sitting in a crowded, windowless Macy's classroom undergoing the first phases of elf training. You can be an entrance elf, a water cooler elf, a bridge elf, train elf, maze elf, island elf, magic window elf, usher elf, cash register elf, or exit elf. We were given a demonstration of various positions in action, acted out by returning elves who were so on stage and goofy that it made me a little sick to my stomach. I don't know that I could look anyone in the eye and exclaim, "Oh my goodness, I think I see Santa." Or, "Can you close your eyes and make a very special Christmas wish?" Everything these elves say seems to have an exclamation point on the end of it. It makes one's mouth hurt to speak with such forced merriment. It embarrasses me to hear people talk this way. I think I'll be a low-key sort of elf. "22,000 people came to see Santa today, and not all of them were well-behaved. Today I witnessed fistfights and vomiting and magnificent tantrums. The back hallway was jammed with people. There was a line for Santa and a line for the women's bathroom. And one woman, after asking me 1,000 questions already, asked, "Which is the line for the women's bathroom?" And I shouted that I thought it was the line with all the women in it. She said, "I'm going to have you fired." I had 2 people say that to me today. "I'm going to have you fired." Go ahead, be my guest. I'm wearing a green velvet costume. It doesn't get any worse than this. Who do these people think they are? I'm going to have you fired, and I want to lean over and say, "I'm going to have you killed." The overall cutest elf is a fellow from Queens named Richie. His elf name is Snowball, and he tends to ham it up with the children, sometimes tumbling down the path to Santa's house. I generally gag when elves get that cute, but Snowball is hands down adorable. You want to put him in your pocket. Yesterday, Snowball and I worked as Santa elves, and I got excited when he started saying things like, "I'd follow you to Santa's house any day, Crumpet." It made me dizzy, his flirtation. By mid-afternoon, I was running into walls. By late afternoon, Snowball had cooled down. By the end of our shift, we were in the bathroom, changing our clothes, and all of a sudden we were surrounded by 5 Santas and 3 other elves. All of them were guys that Snowball had been flirting with. Snowball just leads elves on. Elves and Santas.
David Sedaris from his Santaland Diaries, as originally broadcast on Morning Edition. He told me about some of the other jobs he's gotten by on over the years.
Probably one of the worst was I picked apples for 3 years in Oregon and New York State. Apples and pears. And, you know, you go and you live on a farm, and the farmer puts you up in a shack or a trailer, and you stay for the season, and you pick fruit every day, which is a nice job. But I stayed after the season 1 year, and I got a job at a canning plant, a cannery. And apples and pears would roll down the conveyor belt, and my job was to pick the leaves off the pears. Stand there for 8 hours, and pears would roll by me. And then I got promoted, and my job was to separate the fancy from the extra fancy. And nobody ever explained to me the difference.
Yeah, what is the criteria?
When a supervisor is in the area, then you can suddenly discriminate between fancy and extra fancy. But otherwise, you're just in a daze. You just sit there, and every now and then you take an apple or a pear and you put it onto a different conveyor belt. And then the ones that are really bad, you put them down a chute, and they're used for baby food.
How long have you been keeping diaries?
I started when I was 19, so I guess it's been about 17 years.
Do you see yourself as ultimately being a professional writer? I mean, would you like to make a living from your writing, or do you see yourself as holding down day jobs for a long time and just writing at night?
Well, I write in the evening. If I have to write during the daytime, I'll sit down and I'll sit at the typewriter for 2 minutes, and then I'll wonder what my hair might look like parted in the middle. And I go into the bathroom and I do that. And then I sit back at the typewriter, and then I'll say, I wonder what it would look like if I had a mole on my cheek. I draw a little mole on my cheek, or I go and brush the cat. I can't do it during the day. I don't know why. So I need to do something during the day. And I wouldn't want any kind of a job where I'm sitting down, because then I wouldn't want to come home at night and sit down.
Mm-hmm.
So I like a job that gets me out and is physical and keeps me moving around.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Sedaris. And David, I want to play another one of the commentaries from your journals that was produced for National Public Radio's Morning Edition. And this is your smoking journals. Is there a story behind keeping a journal of this part of your life?
No, usually for the radio, Ira and I will come up with a theme, and mm-hmm. then I'll search for material that relates to it.
Mm-hmm.
And and I might record like 20 minutes worth, and then it gets cut down to time.
Right.
So those were just the incidents that made it onto the radio.
Okay, let's hear it.
August 12th, 1992. I rode my bike to the boat pond in Central Park, where I bought myself a cup of coffee and sat down on a bench to read. I lit a cigarette and was enjoying myself when the woman seated 12 feet away on the other side of the bench began waving her arms in front of her face. I thought she was fighting off a bee. She waved her arms and called out, "Excuse me, do you mind if we make this a non-smoking bench?" I don't know where to begin with a statement like that. Do you mind if we make this a non-smoking bench? There is no we. Our votes automatically cancel one another out. What she meant was, do you mind if I make this a non-smoking bench? I could understand it if we were on an elevator or locked together in the trunk of a car, but this was outdoors. Who did she think she was? This woman was wearing a pair of sandals that are always a sure sign of trouble. They looked like the sort of shoes Moses would have worn. I looked at her sandals, and I looked at her rapidly moving arms, and I crushed my cigarette. I acted like it was no problem, and then I stared at the pages of my book, hating her and Moses both, the two of them. The trouble with aggressive non-smokers is that they feel they're doing you a favor by not allowing you to smoke. They seem to think that one day you'll thank them for those 15 seconds added to your life. What they don't understand is that is just another 15 seconds I can spend hating their guts and plotting revenge. I sat on the bench and stared at my crushed cigarette. I figured that if I were to leave, it would give her too much pleasure, so I decided to stay and wait her out. My cigarette looked lonesome on the ground, and I promised it that as soon as this woman left, we could spend some time together. I waited. I waited and waited, all the time craving that cigarette. I thought about lighting up again and saying that it was a non-smoking bench for an hour, and now it's a smoking bench. I had suffered, and now it was her turn. That's the we. We suffer. Some of us suffer more than others. Some of us punish ourselves, and some of us punish others. Her sandals punished my eyes, and my cigarette punished hers. I put out my cigarette, but she did not remove her sandals, so I guess she won. May 27th, 1991. My school insurance runs out in a few weeks, so I made an appointment and went for a checkup. I stood around the examining room for 20 minutes, afraid to poke around as every so often a nurse or some confused patient would open the door and wander into the room. And it's bad enough to be caught in your underpants, but even worse to be caught in your underpants scratching out a Valium prescription on someone else's pad. When the doctor finally came, he looked over my chart and said, "Hey, we have almost the exact same birthday. I'm one day younger than you." And that does wonders for your morale. He started in by asking some preliminary questions, and then he said, "Do you smoke?" "Only cigarettes and pot," I answered. He gave me a look and said, "Only cigarettes and pot?" "Not crack," I said. "Never touch the stuff. Cigars either. Nasty habit." January 7th, 1993. I was at work defrosting someone's freezer when I heard the EPA's report on secondhand smoke. It was on the radio and they repeated it over and over again. It struck me the same way that previous EPA reports must have struck auto manufacturers and the owners of chemical plants, as reactionary and unfair. The report indicts smokers, especially smoking parents, as being guilty of criminal recklessness, as if these were people who kept loaded pistols lying on the coffee table, crowded alongside straight razors and mugs of benzene. Over Christmas, we looked through boxes of family pictures and played Find Mom, Find the Cigarette. There's one in every picture. We've got photos of her pregnant, leaning towards a lit match, and others of her posing with the newborn baby, the smoke forming a halo above our heads. It gave us a warm feeling, these pictures. She smoked in the bathtub where we'd find her drowned butts, lined in a neat row beside the shampoo bottle. She smoked through meals and often used her plate as an ashtray, explaining that we should not attempt to perform this trick in public. Mom's theory was that if you cook the meal and do the dishes, then you're allowed to use your plate however you like. It made sense to us. Even after she was diagnosed with lung cancer, she continued to smoke, though less often. On her final trip to the hospital, sick with pneumonia, she told my father she'd left something at home and had him turn the car around. And there, standing at the kitchen counter, she entertained what she knew to be her last cigarette, and I hoped that she enjoyed it. It never occurred to any of us that my mother might quit smoking. Picturing her without a cigarette was like imagining her on water skis. All of us are left to choose our own quality of life and take pleasure where we find it, with the understanding that, like Mom used to say, sooner or later, something's going to get you. Something got me the moment I returned home from work and Hugh delivered his interpretation of the EPA report. He tells me that I'm no longer allowed to smoke in any room which he currently occupies. Our apartment is small, four tiny rooms. I told him that seeing as I pay half the rent, I should be allowed to smoke half the time we're in the same room. He agreed on the condition that every time I light a cigarette, all the windows must be open. It's cold outside.
That's David Sedaris, a commentary originally heard on National Public Radio's Morning Edition. Now, do you talk to strangers with the kind of intimacy that you speak on the radio about your personal experiences? Or even talk to friends that way? Or does radio bring out something very personal in you?
No. I think radio is just a little bit more, you know, when you're on the radio, people don't know what you look like, and you're just a voice. So there's something there for people to imagine. And your friends know what you look like. And you've sat around with your friends, boring them for years. And there's no mystery there.
David Sedaris will be back with us after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Sedaris. He reads from his diaries on NPR's Morning Edition. Now, I really like the way you read. Are you an actor?
No, I've been in a couple plays before, but when I'm on stage, I never know what to do with my hands. And I always wind up putting them in my pocket. It doesn't matter what it is I'm supposed to be doing at the moment. I'm thinking, what do I do with my hands? What do I do with my hands? So I can be on stage if I have a piece of paper in front of me, but you take the paper away and I'm a mess. I was, growing up, I had like dozens of nervous habits. I would My teachers would only send notes home to my mother saying that maybe you should come in and we can talk about David's special problems. I would roll my eyes back into my head. That was one of them. You know, you probably met people like that, that they have to close their eyes really intensely and for about 10 seconds at a pop. And another one was to shake my head, just sort of jerk my head so I could feel my brain rattling around. It felt so good to me. And I had, or... I would be in class and I had to make some kind of noise with my throat. And gradually the habits sort of faded away. And the first time I got on stage, they all came back. Just before I went on stage, I thought, boy, I remember when I used to do that with my head. And I got on stage, and afterwards people said, what happened out there? I said, oh, it was the lights, you know, they're so bright. It was the lights caused me to do that. If I think about all those habits can return to me, all I have to do is think about them at any given time.
Here they come. Well, I guess it was, it must have been pretty frightening to be on stage and feel out of control with all these old habits overtaking you.
Oh, terrifying. And they can come back at any moment. That's what's so frightening about it. Like, even now, if I'll, it'll just visit me, the thought, oh, I remember when I used to jerk my head around, and then there it'll be back.
I bet you're very good at impressions. In your Sandaland diaries, you do a version of Away in a Manger, as it might have been sung by Billie Holiday, had she put out a Christmas album late in her life. And you really have it down, that the older Billie Holiday style.
When I was young, my dad has a great record collection, and he was giving me Billie Holiday records like in the third grade. And I especially love her very towards the very end. But what's so great about Billie Holiday, too, is that she would never put out a Christmas album.
Oh, exactly. I know. Well, precisely.
Like, I could never sing, even in my fantasies, I could never sing Strange Fruit. I could never sing a song that Billie Holiday actually sang, because that would be a sacrilege.
Let me play the part of the journal that you recorded for NPR in which you did Away in a Manger as sung, as Billie Holiday would have sung it had she recorded a Christmas album in the latter part of her life.
Away in a manger, no crib for a bed. The little Lord Jesus lay down his sweet head.
Are there any impressions you can do for us of other singers?
I could never do Billie Holiday doing any of the songs that she does, that she would have done, because that would be sort of a sacrilege to me. And then you would have something directly to compare it to. But I like Billie Holiday singing like the Madonna songbook.
'Cause I am living in a material world, and I am a material girl.
That's wonderful. That's absolutely surreal.
You think that's okay?
Yes.
Because if it doesn't sound good, I would, you know.
No, it's good. How did you start? What made you start doing things that were wildly inappropriate for Billie Holiday to sing? I mean, you know why it works so well? Billie Holiday's older voice is just, it's so kind of drenched in emotion, mm-hmm. and everything that she's been through. And her voice is shot, but her timing is perfect. And anyway, so how did you start doing absolutely inappropriate material for her?
I was just walking down the street one day, and I started doing it. I can't remember the first song. I think maybe it was Up, Up, and Away or something like that. It was And I would just listen to the radio and think, well, what if she had done this song? And what was so great about her was that she didn't do any of those songs. The songs that she did, Billie Holiday doing, let's say, a Madonna song reminds you how lousy the lyrics to Madonna songs are. Or to most songs that you hear on the radio.
Yeah.
Except country songs, I think that they still have a lot of good lyrics in them.
You know, when you're doing a day job like cleaning, does it affect your, like, sense of yourself, your identity? Are you able to say, well, you know, I'm a writer, I make my living cleaning, or do you think, oh gosh, I'm going to be cleaning the rest of my life, I really wanted to be a writer, and I'm just stuck here cleaning? Some people it really gets to when they have a day job that doesn't fit with what it is that they really, really want to be doing.
Well, I mean, like I said, I write in the evening, so, I mean, I guess I could stay home all during the day and then say, well, I'm a writer now, but I don't really see the point.
Uh-huh.
And the cleaning part of it, I like to think that all work is pretty much equal. It doesn't really matter what you do. It doesn't bother me, the work. I like it. There's a before and an after. I mean, I like cleaning someone's home if they're really filthy. That's my favorite. But some of the people I clean for, it's clean when I get there. And there's really not that much for me to do. So you don't feel like there's a before and an after. So I'd much rather go to a slob's house and because afterwards they look at it like you've done something they could never possibly do. Like you have retuned the engine to the car. Like it was something that took, or you have removed their kidney. Like you did something that required such skill, and it was a skill that they could never, ever master. Anyone can plug in a trained chimp could vacuum an apartment.
Well, David Sedaris, it's really been great to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
David Sedaris writes and cleans houses in New York. He reads from his diaries on NPR's Morning Edition. His next reading will be about cleaning houses, and it's likely to run next week. Our thanks to his producer, Ira Glass. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.